Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
Life is full of personal wins, whether it's cleaning your house, getting that dream car, or checking off your to-do list. Winning at life is a great feeling. And with the State Farm Personal Price Plan, you can keep winning when you create an affordable price just for you by bundling home and auto. So give yourself a round of applause. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with a personal price plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 545. Well, we added a second show at Comic-Con for Nerdist Podcast. It'll be at 7:30 at the Balboa Theater. So go find tickets for that on the internets. And I joined the Oddball Comedy Festival, which is an insane comedy festival that's touring. I think there's like 20 dates. I'm doing most of them. I'm not doing all of them, but we have a ton of places that we're going to Tampa and Charlotte and Atlanta and Bristow, Virginia and New York and Pennsylvania and Salt Lake City and Mountain View and Irvine, and and the lineup is ridiculous. It is absolutely ridiculous. It's Louis C.K., Sarah Silverman, Aziz, Amy Schumer, Gaffigan, Bill Burr, me, a bunch of other people it's insane. The lineup is insane, and the venues are crazy, crazy big, so it's going to be an experience. If you go to oddballfest.com, you can check all the dates and see who all is going to be on which shows, and please come out. It's going to be really fun. A little nervous. I mean, it's one thing to do like a club or even a small theater, but to do like amphitheaters, that is a whole different thing. You got to like take your time so your voice hits the back of the place. Oh, it's going to be exciting. So come on out if you can, and see a lot of great comedy. I'd like to thank for sponsoring this episode of the Nerdist Podcast, World of Tanks Blitz. World of Tanks Blitz is a mobile version of the award-winning MMO World of Tanks, which has over 85 million players worldwide. So it's a lot like the PC version, but they've specifically optimized it for mobile gameplay on iPhone and iPad. It has amazing reviews. You can get this impressive roster of over 90 tanks. It's really short 7x7 tank battles. The graphics are amazing. You can create a platoon. You can play with your friends. It's out now. If you go to wotblitz.com/nerdist, you can check it out, and you absolutely should. I mean, if you're just looking for a game to play on the fly and be able to go back to, World of Tanks Blitz will take care of the hunger that your brain has to be distracted by fun graphical battle element type situations. So there you go, World of Tanks Blitz. Thanks for sponsoring this episode of the Nerdist Podcast, which is Andy Serkis, who you may know as Gollum, of course, but also he was Caesar in Dawn of Planet of the Apes, which is out now. He's done amazing things with motion capture, but also he directs and he plays music and he writes and he really is, I'm going to use the term, a Renaissance man. And usually I cringe when I hear that term because I'm like, oh yeah, sure. But he really is, and really interesting. And another great accent this week. We had Alfred Molina last week and now Andy Serkis. So we are a horn aplenty of fantastic accents. And I really, really, really enjoy talking to him. So here is the Nerdist Podcast number 545 with Andy Serkis.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Are we recording? Are we doing it already?
Yeah, yeah. Open it up.
Oh, yeah, this is... cool. We just started this recently. This is our guest book. So we decided to start having...
We decided to start having guests sign this, and then when it fills up, we're going to auction it off for a charity. We got Morgan Freeman here. There's Larry King, Tom Cruise. It's good. It's a good book. Good book.
It's an easy read.
And soon, hopefully, it will have the name Andy Serkis in here.
We'll somewhere. See how this goes, Chris.
What if he's like... So this is essentially our audition for you to sign our guest book. So if
and
this goes...
you and us, too. You decide at the end if you want to.
Yeah, that's right. Maybe we're auditioning you, Andy Serkis. No, we're not. No, the balance of power is very heavily shifted in your favor. I don't know if you remember this, but I moderated the Hobbit panel. Two years ago. And I had a really amazing... First of all, it was really fun. But of course, I felt so bad because, you know, one of the first questions is like, do the voice. And I'm like, oh, no. And so as a moderator, I'm in this... My emotions are split because I go... This poor guy for 14 years, you know, people are like, do the voice. And you obliged. But then the other side of me is like, I know that 6,000 people here are going to be mad if they don't. You know, it's like, so I just know that I knew that it was that it was an ask.
Well, thank you.
But you were very sweet about it and you obliged. And the audience, of course, went absolutely crazy. But my experience... You know, on the panel, I think this is hilarious. Ian McKellen, very charming on the panel. Afterwards, we're all taking the picture afterwards, and I was like, you know, it was so great to meet you. Because I thought, oh, I got an in, you know, like an in. I go, I was just, you know, you're so amazing. You're such a big fan. And he didn't even look at me, and he just walked away, and he goes, right. And I'm like, oh, no. But I think that's okay, because it's Ian McKellen.
He's not wrong.
He's not
wrong. It was a pleasure to meet him.
It was.
He was just confirming your ideas.
Right.
Yeah.
But we're here to talk about you and your pretty insane career. Not just with acting and motion capture, but directing. And you know, I also read that you studied graphic design, and there's just all these different artistic disciplines.
Yeah.
That I just sort of see you as a guy who just likes to play in a lot, fuck around basically. He's just like a guy who likes to fuck around a lot.
Lots of different ways.
Yeah,
that's a good way to put it.
So tell me a little bit about. Are you hearing Andy? Okay.
We started,
Andy.
Oh, is that on?
Yeah, I know. It doesn't feel like it. It feels very informal.
Okay. Well, that. Oh, thank you so much,
Kyle. I know you just got back here, but it just felt to me like you weren't really ready to settle into that chair.
Nice day to walk.
Can you please
work them hams?
Can you grab my laptop? It's just on the table in the dressing room.
Yeah,
okay, thanks. You're very nice. Take these just in case.
Oh, yeah.
So you wanted to come back again. Good catch. Points for you. Get out. All right. I love it.
We got to think of something else for him to get once he gets back. This is nice not having him in the room.
Just throw like a star tantrum and just say, like, I need a fucking banana. And then when he gets back, we'll just keep sending him out. Are you okay with
that?
So I read that you grew up traveling a lot, that you spent a lot of time in Iraq. You grew up in Iraq?
Well, I didn't grow up in Iraq. I spent my dad was Iraqi. He passed away 2 years ago. He and my elder sisters grew up in Baghdad, actually. My mum, she went over there to be a teacher. He was a doctor there. And I went over there for holidays, every year until I was about 11 years old. So I just spent a considerable amount of time there.
So what was the culture like at the time, and what were you seeing, and what was the experience?
It was the most amazing. You know, I spent a lot of time all over the Middle East, actually. We went to Syria and to Beirut, and I spent time in the Lebanon, and just, you know, just had the most amazing holidays there. Really, you know, great people, you know, such a lot going on. It was, you know, and I've got lots of relatives over there as well, in particularly in Iraq. Just went to lots of historical sites, to Damascus and to Babylon and to all of that, you know, growing up, seeing all these amazing kind of places was just incredible. So
when you were in school, was it in history class, was it easier to learn the stuff about like historical events because you had actually seen and been to these places?
Yeah, I guess it was. I mean, I was fascinated. I was massively into archaeology as a kid. When I was about 7 years old, I knew all about the Tutankhamun. And I mean, at that time, it was the big exhibition had just come over. It was in the early 70s. And you know, seeing King Tutankhamun... I was just massively into Egyptology and to all of that. You know, the Middle East was I felt very, I did feel very connected to it.
Well, it's funny because when we go over to England or Europe, I think as Americans, we go, look at all the history here.
Yeah.
But then for you going over to the Middle East going, wow, look at all the history. Yeah. It actually goes, you know, it goes far, far, far deeper than what you guys are used to seeing.
I guess. I mean, you know, we used to do things like, you know, go up the River Tigris, and there's a particular way of cooking fish there, which is a kind of, you know, you literally catch the fish and then you stake them out. And I just remember having these incredible experiences of camping out in the desert and all of that kind of stuff. And it was, I mean, that was my childhood. So it was, wow. But it was great. It was really exciting. That's really, really, cool. Really exciting. Watching cinema on, you know, in outdoor cinema at the place called the Alweer Club in the middle of Baghdad, and watching lizards crawling across the screen and just thinking, gosh, this is watching Bud Abbott and Lou Costello movies and lizards kind of crawling across the screen. Yeah, I mean, that was the sort of upbringing I had.
Wow. And do you think that because this sort of cross-cultural mashup that was your childhood and ultimately is your genealogy, do you think that informed in any way why you like to do so many different things, because you like to just mash up a lot of different things?
I think that's probably is something to do with it. Yeah, I mean, my mum she isn't a teacher anymore. She taught disabled kids, and she was quite artistic. She liked, you know, she liked painting, and we often put on little theatre shows at home in our garage. I remember doing all the like Grimm's fairy tales with my sister. But you know, we used to put these crazy plays on in our garage together, and I mean, I was very much, you know, alongside the kind of Egyptology and stuff when I was young, I discovered a love for drawing and painting, so that's what sort of got me going. I also played musical instruments, and you know, I think you're right. In fact, now I'm talking about it, I am now realizing that I am the classic jack of all trades, master of diddly squat.
Now, do you think that idea is important? Because I like to do a lot of different stuff too, and sometimes I go, I don't know if I'm really, I'm not really a mass, you know, like there's not one discipline. But then I think, yeah, but I'm also not bored, you know? Like, is it fun to get to that point when you master something and it's like, what the fuck do I do now? You know?
Yeah, no, true. Well, when I get there, I'll let you know. And then, but it's, no, I think variety for me. Actually, it's a realization because then I went to, you know, I went to college. I went to study graphic design and visual arts, and I thought, this is absolutely what I want to do. I know I want to do this. Equally, I was into mountaineering, and I actually went to Lancaster University because that happened to be near the Lake District, and the Lake District has got fantastic rock climbs. But I thought, this is, I want to spend my life behind a drawing board, designing creating stuff. But actually, when I got to Lancaster, I realized that in the first year you had to do a subsidiary course, and I really hadn't checked it out properly, and there happened to be a theatre studies course, which I thought, well, that sounds vaguely artistic, you know, I can maybe design some sets or posters or something creative, you know. And then I started getting involved in the performing and acting, and then it was literally, I did one play that just went bang overnight, this is what I want to do, I want to become an actor. And that was a real epiphany, but I never stopped sort of you know, the appetite for creating shows and light, you know, lighting and directing and all of that sort of stuff was still milling around. But I really did then focus in on acting for the next 10 years, where I was, you know, I then got a job in a local, what would be your kind of stock theatre, which is our repertory theatre. My first job was I was in part of a company that did 14 plays back to back, rehearsing during the day, performing at night, and just got a taste for characters, really, and evolving characters and having to make decisions about creating characters very quickly. All the other stuff was still sort of around. Music was very important to me. I was really big into jazz. I played in bands. I was a tenor saxophonist. And then I suppose I realized later on in life that actually it doesn't really matter what you do as long as you're doing it. You know, you're still telling a story of some kind. You're still sharing something with an audience. You're still connecting in some way. It actually all amounts to very much the same thing, really.
So what is it when you're looking at a character, for instance, what are some of the questions that you ask, and how do you sort of find whatever you think the essence of that thing is? Especially when you're doing repertory, where you really just don't have time. It's like, well, we're doing this tonight, so yeah. You've really got to figure it out.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose I was lucky enough to, when I started, the director that I first worked with is a guy called Jonathan Petherbridge, and he, you know, and the time, I suppose, it was, you know, in the 80s, Thatcher's Britain, it was quite a polarized society. And it was quite a political theatre that I was involved in, I suppose. And I suppose I've always, when I approach characters, or you know, from my education as an actor, was always your job as an actor is to go out and research and gather the information, bring it back, put it together, make sense of it, and share it with an audience, and try and have some, you know, try and change the world in some way. I mean, that really, in a basic form, is I always saw acting as a service. You know, and that really still holds true till today. I still think of it as, you know, we're lucky, we're very privileged, where we get to experience all these different lives and become different things and empathise with different belief systems and inhabit different worlds and characters. But actually, it's for that privilege, it's your job to come back and then share that with an audience, and you know, make them see something about or respond to the human condition in different ways. So it's always had a purpose, I suppose, is what I'm saying.
Sure.
You know.
And do you find that when you're, I mean, I don't know if this is getting too serious about the craft of acting, but is it? But
when, never, we can get far more serious about the craft.
But when you're sort of digging around these characters, particularly if it's a character that you don't identify with right off the bat, but you start, obviously you have to adopt their point of view, you have to empathize with them in some way, even if it's a character that you as Andy wouldn't empathize with.
Yeah.
So do you learn things about yourself in that process, or do you kind of, I don't know, has that done anything for you in terms of being an empathetic human being?
Yeah, I mean, there's kind of the flip side of being an empathetic human being and a sort of grasshopper that changes what he or she thinks is a fine one when you're an actor. You know what I mean? Because you can't actually go back to what you were before you've played a character, I believe. You can't sort of, if you've been through that experience, you can't sort of retract all of those things that go up to make you what you are today, because you've bought into them in some way. I mean, I'll give you an example. I did a Mike Leigh film called Career Girls, and Mike Leigh's process for as an actor is very all immersive, totally immersive. You work for months researching characters and working on characters, and you don't know what your, there's no script. You don't know what your role's going to be in the movie. You're not allowed to talk to any of the other actors.
Oh wow!
You end up listening to music, you know, being with people that are about the character that you're going to play in the movie. You're totally cut off from all your frames of reference, and I was playing this character that was a futures broker. So I went and worked in the city in London for a while, and you know, in a kind of Wolf of Wall Street way, you know, went, you know, learned to trade, you know, and it was just months and months and months of just being with this group of people that I almost forgot what the outside world was like. And then you come out the other side of something like that, and I never wanted to go into it. I just thought, this is not a world I'm really that interested in. It's certainly not me as a person. But they became people I got to know and like and hung out with, and they treated me very well. And you sort of think, well, people, at the end of the day, people are people, you know. People are, you go in with a certain amount of prejudice, and actually once you start to get to know people, they are as equal and varied as any, and it's a life lesson. That is a real life lesson.
Well, I guess it also has to do with, you know, when you see someone, there's, you know, there's maybe one or two layers of dimension if you don't really understand what it is that they do. But then when you actually start asking questions and get to know them as a human being, then it just starts adding all this dimension where you're like, oh, because the superficial frames of reference you don't necessarily have a way into, because you don't, you're a performer and you're a you know, like, so for you, why the fuck would I want to trade, you know?
Yeah, right.
But I'm sure that you, because of just your process, probably found ways to go, oh, okay, so this is analogous to this, and this is, oh, I see how this works.
Exactly. That's exactly right. At the end of the day, you sort of, part of you kind of goes, well, my job here is to assemble all this and make sense of it and you know, shape this into something which is going to, again, you know, tell you know, it function as a character in a story, and it's not you know, you're not just living, you're not living it for no reason.
What's the most difficult form of storytelling for you? Like, what do you find to be the most challenging between music and performance and directing and, you know, or mocap or writing, or what is it to you that is the most difficult?
Oh man, I mean, I have written, and I've written a few screenplays. I actually really love the process of writing, although it's by far the most taxing, by far the most taxing thing, because you know, being on your own, it is great at times, but equally it's very, very difficult. I don't know. I think they're all. You just realise that. I just realise that they're all so. There's so many layers to all of these different disciplines that there's a certain amount of. You're only ever going to get so far in the time that we have on this planet. There is only. I'm constantly worried about the lack of time, I suppose.
Oh, yeah.
I'm constantly worried about the lack of time.
It's funny, you don't worry about it when you're 20. You're like, fuck, well, this is the never ending pasta bowl of time.
Because it is at that point.
It is at that point. And then, you know, as the years start to tick on a little bit, and you're like, shit,
I wanted to do that. And I really wanted to do that. And I'm going to do that. Yeah, so I mean, directing is really where everything's focused at the moment for me, you know, very much so. And the Imaginarium and the creation of that. I don't know if you know about this.
I know about the Imaginarium. It's basically this creative enclave of.
Yeah.
Yeah, that basically, I assume, to foster creativity, basically. Right?
That's exactly what it was. I mean, I had such an amazing time down in New Zealand working with Peter Jackson and all the gang. And, you know, it's such a brilliant, you know, melting pot of creativity down there, which is very much has a can-do attitude to it. And, you know, the British film industry, love it though I do, and, you know, I'm part of it, but it's so cottage industry and so small, you know. I don't know how we've got to this place where the vision that the you know, the years of David Lean and the big expansive directors that really told big stories seemed to, at a certain point, you know, a few years ago, actually it's getting a bit better now, but it sort of had closed down, become very myopic, and it was very much about telling small stories of two or three people in a room. You know, I'd had such an incredible experience down in New Zealand. I thought, well, all these brilliant minds are coming together and just trying to find solutions rather than seeing the problems in everything. And I'd like to import a bit of that back home. And because performance capture, motion capture, it was virtually unknown in the UK, really. There were a couple of dry-for-hire studios who'd make, you know, good businesses, but it wasn't sort of creatively led in the way that I'd experienced it. So the Imaginarium was really an idea about creating a digital creative lab for furthering the art and craft of performance capture, but also, you know, bringing together writers, directors, concept artists, and being able to, say, take a lump of digital clay, mould it into a shape, and get it up on the stage and played by an actor. It'd be like a creature workshop for the digital age, really. But then beyond that, it was to service other people's films and video games and characters in their films and video games, but also then to direct and to create our own. We've got a production entity as well, so we're producing our own material. But I love being around, and I loved my student days, and I love the energy of students, and I love now that we've got lots of kind of interns and young people coming through from various different colleges, like, you know, Bradford and Bournemouth Art College and all the film colleges, who are, you know, they're starting to do kind of mocap degree modules, and that's kind of quite amazing, really. So we give them, we sort of build bridges to industry for them, and it's just a really cool feel, you know. It's kind of
because obviously, you know, stage acting is a little bit bigger because you have to convey to people who are, you know, sitting farther back, and you need to. I would assume film seems a little more like, well, you have to be, your performance is a little more subtle because you're this bit, you're enormous on a screen, and so the more you emote, the more it kind of hits people in the face. But with this performance capture, it sort of seems like, well, you have to be very careful about every movement, but it does have to have, it probably has to be a notch above if you were just, you know, doing live action on camera, because you have to give the digital artist something to play with, I would imagine.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good question, that. And of course, people deal with it in different ways. And actually, it says a lot. It says really more about the actor who puts on a motion capture suit. I've always said, and it's true in my opinion, that you know, I've never approached a role. If I was playing a live action role in a film, I wouldn't necessarily approach it any differently than playing a performance captured role, in the sense that it's still about putting yourself under the microscope. It's still about the emotional truth of the character. You build the character in the same way. You find a physicality, a psychology, and you embody the role. And I would do that if I was playing, you know, if I was putting on a costume and getting going on set or on stage. And with a performance captured role, you're doing that essentially without any aid from costume and makeup, or, you know, making sure you've got the right shoes, or, you know, none of that applies. But you're still using your acting chops and imagination to create the role. And the difference is, I mean, look, if you're playing a character like an ape or you know, Gollum or something like that, which has a particular physicality, yes, there's a lot of work and research that needs to, and training that needs to go into creating that physicality. But you're not in terms of the level, the performance level or the pitching, you can't let the energy drop below a certain level because the cameras, it's just performance capture cameras are basically another set of cameras that are filming you. So you can't do any less than be truthful.
Right.
But the size of the physicality is really, it just has to remain truthful. So that's, you know, it's a curious one. When you film performance capture, you can either film it, I mean, if you're in a motion capture volume, you can either film it conventionally with coverage so you know what the size of frame is that you're working to, or you can just play out the entire scene and then put camera coverage in afterwards. And some actors like to work that way because it feels a little bit more like a theatrical piece, and certain directors like to do that because they like to let the scenes run on in their entirety. Or you can shoot it much more like conventional coverage. You know, in certain scenes, in certain moments, it does help to know that you're in a close-up. In certain scenes, it does, you know, you just want to be free to play the character. So it is a sort of, in a rather roundabout way of saying, it is a sort of hybrid. It is both. It has the energy and the muscularity of a theatrical performance, but the stillness of a film performance.
Yeah, but you don't have the. You can't really lean on anything in terms of, you know, if you're doing a period piece, if you're on a set and it's live action, well, you're in wardrobe and you can look around and it's like, oh, there's a bunch of old-timey stuff here and that other person is dressed that way. And so it's the environment is inherently immersive in that way. I mean, obviously there's, you know, there's a crew on the other side staring at you, but ultimately there are some ways. But with this type of performance, it just seems like it's all in your brain. Like, it's just all in your brain.
It isn't. I mean, when we were shooting Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, you know, now we shot on location. Every single scene was shot on location. So you're acting opposite your fellow actors. The only thing is that you're not dressed in an ape costume. You're wearing a suit with markers on. And that is the only difference. You're not wearing any sort of prosthetic makeup. You're in many ways, if you compare to what we went through on Dawn of the Planet of the Apes compared to the original Planet of the Apes movies, they had layers of latex. Very thick.
Well, they had to move their faces like crazy to
get the mouths.
Revolutionary makeup for its time. But actually, you know, I read and heard, you know, sort of documentary footage of Kim Hunter and Roddy McDowall talking about all they could do was to keep their faces moving to make those masks seem like they had life in. You know, whereas we can play the internal emotions of a scene or you know, very subtly, totally. I mean, a particular character like Caesar, who's quite internal in many ways, it's more about the stillness and what he's thinking and feeling rather than showing. So that's what we can do. So if you combine that with being, you know, we shot this in the rainforest outside of Vancouver, and then, you know, in 100% humidity in New Orleans, where the ape community set was built for this, and it's as live as you know, and as real as acting with your fellow actors in a live action movie.
You just don't have to sit in makeup for 4 hours.
Exactly. Exactly.
Which is a nice. You've really kind of managed to carve out a nice little niche there.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So what other kinds of things are you? So when you're working on this, or you're working on, I mean, how many years were you in New Zealand? Like, what was your? Did you figure out what the entire time frame was?
Well, I had 7 birthdays down there. put it that way. I started in early 2000, and the you know, we finished The Hobbit shooting the my part of directing the second unit, finishing that on The Hobbit was 2011. So,
oh my god,
2011.
I mean, that's
Oh, I can't remember. Yeah, so I can't even remember. No, we started in 2011. So 2012. So it was 12 years of over the course of 12 years. I mean, obviously, I was back in England and back and forth.
I mean, that's yeah. You know, I know you just. I mean, you know, obviously, you look at that as one piece of your life. Like, oh, well, that's just one job, one piece of my life that went on for 12 years, but. To most people, if someone said, oh, I've been doing this for 12 years, you'd be like, Jesus Christ, yeah. That's a long
time. That's your career.
You're a master at this one thing. But really, it's just bizarre that, particularly in this industry, that you know these jobs are like mobile homes, basically. It's like, well, this is just one little piece. I mean, what are you doing down there besides that during this time?
Well, I mean, you know, it was kind of like I'd learned such an enormous amount. And we were sort of building a methodology with performance capture because it was relatively unknown at the time. And when I'd gone down there originally, it was to play. You know, my first call from my agent was, Andy, they're doing this film of Lord of the Rings down in New Zealand. This is to do a voice of an animated character. It's 3 weeks' work, you know.
Is there any chance it's going to be 12 years' work? None.
And I actually said, to my agent, oh, God, look, there must be a dozen good roles in that movie. Can you not get me a decent part? You know, and... And they said, well, it's Gollum. And I was like, oh, God, Gollum's a really good role. And how come it's only 3 weeks? And how come it's, you know, anyway, when I eventually met Peter and you know, we started talking about it, Peter and Fran Walsh, and we met and immediately got on. I mean, we really did immediately get on. He just said, look, I want to start employing this thing. I'm not exactly sure how it's going to work, but there's this thing called motion capture. And we can sort of capture what you're doing, but I don't know if it's going to work. I want you to play Gollum, and I want you to be on set and play opposite the guys who are playing Frodo and Sam. And you know, the key thing was that he didn't want to have them act against the tennis ball on a stick for an animated character that was later going to be put in because sure. Gollum drives all of the scenes. He's very divisive in all the rest of it. Why should those two guys have to make character decisions for something that's not there? So that was his starting point. And he'd seen an audition tape that I'd done and kind of liked it, and we talked about it. But it was really unformed. So back to your point about what was I doing down there for all that time, it was you know, we were you know, apart from shooting the scenes, I had to go back and shoot everything again because we shot everything on location. My first scene on Lord of the Rings was literally one of the penultimate scenes in the Return of the King, which was climbing, which was attacking Frodo and Sam. It was my first day, in fact, on Lord of the Rings back in 2000 was jumping on top of Frodo and Sam as they were climbing up to Mordor. Scene 652 out of whatever it was.
Jesus.
And I was like 6,500 foot up a mountain in a lycra bodysuit, not really knowing what I was doing. And the crew really not knowing what I was doing. And Peter looking at me giggling and laughing away. And from there, it was sort of like, well, we're going to use this thing called motion capture, but you're going to act. So I was filmed on set with the guys, and then I had to go back and repeat some of the scenes and do Gollum's physicality using motion capture. And then that all sort of evolved over the course of going from just body capture with filming my facial performance and the animators copying that to facial capture in King Kong and, you know, putting markers on and that driving the digital mask, and then through to, you know, to Tintin, and then... you know, and it just sort of went on, and this life, this, you know, second family down in New Zealand, really, that I had, and kids coming down and going to school there, and everything, you know, it just all sort of took over. So this does actually, this year, really, with the coming to the end of Middle Earth for The Last of the Hobbit, it truly is the end of a big, big, long chapter. Not that I won't go back to New Zealand, because I've got so many friends and workmates and projects and things that will probably continue.
You kind of lived there for 12 years.
Yeah, exactly. So although it's very, 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 you know, close to Peter and Fran and Philippa and all of, you know, the big, big sort of central family, it's actually the world just does seem a tiny place. And quite frankly, you know, it's a 28-hour flight to New Zealand, and going anywhere else, even coming, you know, like I flew in last night, I got in, you know, from London last night, a 12-hour flight to London is nothing. It's just nothing.
Did you say 28 from England to New Zealand?
Yeah, New Zealand.
Is it, it's, so do you stop in LA and then...
Stop in LA, or you can go via Singapore and, you know, then you fly to Auckland and then you fly down to Wellington. So
I can't even fucking, like, I mean, I've been to Australia, I've been to Europe, but... Still, just the idea that you could be on a plane for 12 hours. You could watch 6 movies and be like, well, 16 more hours to go. Like, that it's, I mean, I'm sure eventually when you get there, you might go, okay. But even, but just along the way, what do you do on, what do you do when you're traveling for 28 hours? What was your routine?
Well, I'm a hopeless sleeper on planes, and I wish I could master that, but I'm not. I just can't. So I read a lot, I watch a lot of movies, and you know, work on scripts and work on what I'm doing. I do love the concentration of knowing that you can't go anywhere except sit there and do what you've got to do. I do actually get.
I mean, I like that for like 5 or 6 hours.
Yeah, I can't handle the 12-hour flight. Was the longest I've ever been on, and I went crazy. And then on the way back, I was like, I can't. I gotta find a pill. I gotta get. I can't. I don't want to be aware of anything.
I just like you. I like the idea of you scrambling on all fours on the plane, just looking for a pill to like. Was this one? Okay. This one. God. But you know, with motion capture though, I think when we got Jurassic Park, I think people were like, the new age of CGs, like it's gonna be, and then it's still, you know, I mean, I think Jurassic Park still holds up in terms of like,
absolutely,
but
well, Ray Harryhausen's movies still hold up, you know,
of course, but I mean, just in terms of the visuals, like, oh, it looks really amazing, but then it still was a long time. I think Gollum was the first time where people were like, oh shit, this character is generated, but it's actually it didn't have that sort of, you know, the kind of Polar Express look where everything's like, hi everybody, you know, because there's just too much
wax figures.
There's too much musculature in the face to capture the emotions. So what would when you first, cuz obviously you're putting a lot of trust into Peter Jackson, you go, "Well, I guess you know what you're doing. You seem good." But then what was the experience the first time that you actually saw it, and how long before you were able to?
I mean, that was the experience of working on Lord of the Rings was, I mean, you knew you were in amazingly safe pair of hands, and I'd seen Heavenly Creatures. I knew Peter's work. I loved Peter's work. I actually thought, God, you know, even before I was anywhere near hoping to be a director, I just thought if I could direct a movie, I want to direct it like that guy because the way he supports performance with camera, it's so beautiful, and the choreography of camera with emotion, and the way he brings it all together is, I think, remarkable. And so I knew it did kind of feel like a special shoot down there, because although it was huge and everyone, there was great anticipation about the movies, it bizarrely felt, and there were 7 units shooting on those films, you know, it felt like 7 independent movies all that happened to have, you know that Pitt was being overseen by Pete. It had a real intimacy about it. I had this experience of a very unique actor's experience of, you know, my fellow, the people I hung out with most, I mean, Gollum's a solitary character, but the people I hung out with most were animators and visual effects artists and the mocap team. And on the whole, I spent more time with them over the course of the 3 years than other cast members, because, you know, they were the fellowship and they all hung out with each other, and, you know, and I was just Gollum on my own, Gollum-ing around. And but the people I really got to know were these incredibly talented, you know, folk who were creating the character alongside me. And so you know, I started to straddle this very, I suppose, I don't think many actors would have had that opportunity to straddle those worlds, actually. And that sort of has just increased over the years. But seeing Gollum, seeing the very first rendered shot of Gollum, there were two amazing moments with Gollum in terms of seeing him. One was seeing the very, very first rendered shot of Gollum, which I remember, you know, very, very vividly seeing. It was in the Two Towers. There's a shot where Gollum has been, where Frodo has led him to the Forbidden Pool, and he's just about to be captured, and Frodo knows he's going to be captured, and Gollum's a little bit suspicious and turns around and looks back at him, calls him, and I remember seeing it, and fully rendered, and it was the very first shot. It was everything that we'd worked towards, all the physical work, all the psychology of the role, all the talk, all the working on set, all of the motion capture, everything, you know, I'd spend a lot of time going around and talking about and sort of referring for the animators after the fact and enduring this long sense of, you know, never finishing a scene on the day, which is the toughest thing as an actor, actually. Not, you know, you're not nailing the scene in one day. And sometimes it being months and months and months or even years before seeing the final shot. But seeing that was kind of like, God, it's all come together. It really has all come together because I know exactly what that character's thinking and feeling. It truly represents what I played as an actor, and it's manifested and amplified through this avatar. And so that was really gratifying. And then the second and most amazing thing kind of got a moment for me was when we opened it and opened the Two Towers in New York at the Ziegfeld Theatre. And when the Gollum Smeagol scene came up and just feeling the audience literally, it was an extraordinary thing. I mean, it just feeling an entire audience just sort of lean forward and just sort of creaking of seats as people were kind of like, it was, I can't really explain it, but it was just phenomenal.
I think it would have been great if just as a joke, Peter Jackson had been like, what do you think of this? And just put in purposely awful footage of this like hand-drawn Gollum. Like, what if I been working on all this time? Nah, we're just fucking with it. But so how did you, because at the panel, Peter Jackson seemed like such a sweet guy, just like such a warm, sweet guy. Yeah. But how did the conversations progress where you said, hey, I would like to direct second unit on this. I would like to now sort of tandem direct with you, Peter Jackson.
No, it didn't happen like that. Because of course, you know, during the course of Lord of the Rings, it became a life down in New Zealand for everybody, and people were doing other things, making short films. And I'd come back to the UK, and I'd made my first short film. And Pete had offered advice and being very supportive. And you know, there was a real sense of, you know, Sean Astin made a short film there with half of the cast in it playing different roles. In fact, and some of the crew playing roles. And I mean, it was a really cool creative time. But Pete knew that I was going to. I sort of wanted to head that way, and so the years had passed, and I played, you know, Kong, and we'd done Tintin, and then I'd gone off and done Caesar, and then he knew that I was thinking about putting the Imaginarium together, and I had this one particular project, a mountaineering project actually, about one of the world's first Victorian female mountaineers. Great stories sort of based around that time in the 1850s in the Alps. And Pete knew I had this idea for a story, and I sort of talked about it. And so then I went off to start, and I started the Imaginarium up, and it took ages to get the funding to put the Imaginarium together. The very, very day that the funders came through for the Imaginarium, and they said, you know, we'd got this quite large amount of money, investors, and they said, look, you're not going to go. If we give you this money, you know, to set the Imaginarium up, you're not going to go anywhere, are you? You're going to stay here. And I went, of course, this is what I've been building towards for all these years. The very evening that happened, I got an email from Peter saying, will you come and direct the second unit on The Hobbit? And so from playing Gollum, reprising Gollum for what would have been 2 weeks, it was then going back for a year and a half.
Oh, my God.
So
how'd you break that news?
Oh my God! I mean, it was
for the company.
Well, I remember. I mean, my wife Lorraine was on the phone to someone, and when I got this email, and I was literally rolling about on the carpet. I was like, the knot in my stomach was so tight that I was like rolling about on the floor.
Can you imagine the luxury problem? It's funny.
No, I know.
It's so funny because you know, like, you go, oh my, that something that could be that amazing is so stressful. You're like, well, do I get to build my dream company or go direct second unit?
I know. Hey, nice problem to have.
Yeah.
But it was just like, it was so overwhelming because it, you know. But anyway, Pete said, look, come down and talk about it. We'll see if we can, we'll make this work. We'll make it work. And you know, that's exactly the sort of person he is. He and Fran and Philippa, they are the most collaborative sort of, compassionate, brilliant filmmakers, but they're also great team leaders. They're also, you know, whilst Pete's making The Hobbit, he's also, Pete and Fran are putting together West of Memphis, which was the, you know, the film about, you know, and helping Damien to get off death row and freeing him, and him coming to New Zealand and visiting us. And, you know, I mean, there's no bounds to Pete's capacity, really. And I really respond to that. And he's such a great mentor and a great human being, because he values everyone's opinion. He leads a team because people want to give him 150%, because he values what people have to offer. And you feel, and there's nothing like it, feeling that, you know, truly valued artistically, you know, and getting people to do that. He and that team have been a hugely, hugely important part of my life. And the fact that in the middle of putting together The Hobbit and making two, which was then going to be three movies, he thoughtfully says, this will be good for Andy, or this will, you know, would you like to come down and do this? This will, you know. And I think also he trusted the fact that I would be able to, because on those films, it's not like directing second unit in the traditional sense, where it's, you know, you're just doing, picking up bits and pieces. These are big, long, you know, you're going to be working with principal cast. We're shooting on location. We're shooting sometimes taking on scenes which haven't been finished. So I think he wanted a continuity of performance, and because he knew that I could direct actors and knew how to work with actors, that would be a good, that would be a great source of continuity for the, you know, because you've got 13 dwarves, you've got Gandalf, you've got all of those guys and all the other characters too, and then the dwarves have got scale doubles, then they've got stunt doubles, you've got 13 scale doubles, 13 stunt doubles, that, you know, and they're switching between main unit and second unit, and so there has to be someone who can kind of keep an eye on that, on the performance aspect of it all, otherwise there's, you know, that's all going to, you know, fall apart. So I think that's what he reckoned I would be able to bring to the table. But what I could learn, he just said, you're going to learn such an enormous amount. And I did. I mean, I was working with a huge crew for 200 days, you know, shooting 3D, shooting, you know, I spent 12 weeks in a helicopter pretty much, you know, for a part of it on location. It was the most phenomenal experience.
So what is it that, I mean, when you sort of look at your life and, like, you know, these are the things that I want to do and these are the things that I want to experience, what is it? Is there kind of a mantra or a guiding principle that comes to mind? Like, how do you, you know, is it always experiment or always grow or always try? Like, what is, because you have done so many things, and I don't know if you could have predicted where your career was going to go. But what do you, when you look at all of it and spending time in the helicopter, like, what are you going forward? Like, what is your important kind of guiding principle?
I think it goes back to this sense of, you know, it goes back really to the sense of, you know, acting or whatever you're doing, the responsibility of the storyteller or the artist to share the, what they've researched. And, you know, that still is very much my guiding thing. It's that you're providing a service. You're a storyteller. And storytellers, like shamans around a campfire, we're providing a service. You know, and because we're lucky enough to be in a position to do it, then do it to the best of your ability. But also the other thing is, the other mantra really is, there, you know, there are two types of people in life: drains and radiators. You know,
I've never heard that.
Yeah, and I just want to continue, hopefully, to not be a drain.
God damn it! That's such a great way to say that, because also, if you put a drain next to a radiator,
yeah,
it starts to turn into a drain.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Right? No, don't you
absolutely,
think? Don't
yeah.
you think drains usually win?
Oh yeah, 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 yeah. Absolutely, and especially on these big, you know, look, these big behemoth productions or these big, you know, it's like setting off on a big oil tanker with a crew for an unending journey, and you've got to get on, and you find very quickly who the drains and the radiators are.
But obviously in a crew that, I mean, like, when you're working with that many, when there are that many moving parts, there are going, just by virtue of probability, there's a fair number of drains, I would imagine. I mean, there just have to be just in that, with those numbers. So
there are very few drains in New Zealand.
Oh,
actually.
Good.
Very few.
Good.
It's a very low percentage of drain ducting down in.
How do you know when you can try to turn a drain into a radiator when you go, this is just a fucking drain. Like, at what point do you kind of go, all right, go be a drain. I'm going to go over here because I don't have time.
Yeah, there is that. There is that. I mean, it's sad to say that we've got a higher percentage of drains in the UK. You know, well, not drains, but sort of like, you know, stop plugs, you know, just sure. Sort of like, you know, it's you get by and you do as much as required, you know. That's the ambition. That's what the Imaginarium, even running a small ship like that, and you know, we've got a great team and they are all cherry picked and it is because they're believers, you know. You just need believers around you,
right,
to make things happen. That's it. If you've got believers around you, then you can get places.
I saw a great quote, or I heard a great quote once that was it was a success quote, and it was what are you willing to do after you do everything that is required to do? Yeah, like, right. So just hearing you sort of say like, oh, they just sort of get by, and it's like they do what they're required to do. Like, what are you willing to do beyond that to do something great? But I guess ultimately you're not going to do that unless you're really passionate about what you're doing.
Yeah.
So do you think it's a passion problem? Do you think that a lack of passion for something creates a drain?
I think, you know, you can always inspire people. You can always, you know, like film crews or you know, not even film crews, any group of people can be inspired by, you know, it does definitely all filter down from leadership. And you can lead by example, you can lead by valuing people. People put it in if they feel valued. That's it. That's really it, I think.
So just
a couple, philosophical, aren't we? Really?
I know. Well, I'm so, no, it just, you know, when I meet a radiator, now that I know that word, I just want to pick your brain apart, because a lot of these podcasts are me also just trying to figure things out too. And so it's really fun for me to talk and understand, like, you know, how does Andy go from this kid who, you know, one day just discovers acting to the Imagineerium and helping to develop motion capture and directing and writing and music and, you know, and like, and just kind of keeping that water level rising, you know?
I mean, I wouldn't say I was, you know, my mum was very creative. My sisters were all creative. But when I said I wanted to go into acting, they were like, really? You've got to be kidding. The silence on the end of the phone was terrifying.
Were they afraid you weren't going to have the stable life that being a graphic artist?
Exactly. Yeah, right. Yeah, actually, I already had that, you know, that kind of...
Yeah.
I'd already had that one and that. But then being an actor was yeah, a million times worse. And that just because of the precariousness of the... And actually, why? You know, but... I don't know. I don't know how the shifts happen from one thing into another, really. But they, because where I'm at the moment, people are sort of starting to go, oh, so well, you're not going to act anymore? Then I'm going, no, of course I'm going to act.
Well, you know, people can only wrap their brains around you doing one thing. That's the thing. People go, oh, so you're just going to do this? Like, no, I'm going to do all of these things.
I want to continue to. Yeah,
it's okay to do that.
I mean, I've recently discovered that I really love. And I haven't done it for a long time, but I used to take pictures, you know, for photography. I love doing that, and I've recently discovered the passion for it again. And it's like. It's just that time thing. It's just that time thing. It's the one thing that kind of really does. And I don't sleep. I am a total insomniac, I now discover.
Really?
Yeah.
How many hours of sleep a night do you think?
I get about 4 hours max.
Feel maybe that's just what you require? Or do you feel like you need more sleep, but you just can't get it?
I probably do need more sleep, because on the other end of the scale, I'm probably a narcoleptic. So I've sort of got this insomnia narcolepsy thing going on, where I can fall asleep very easily too during the day. They're probably linked in some way.
I know that you also you did a movie with David Tennant, who I love.
Oh yeah,
I love David Tennant.
He's great, Dave.
But it also makes me feel like. I think you could have been a good doctor. I think you could have been a good, or a master. You could have been a good doctor or a master.
Yeah. Well, you know, maybe one day. he was great. Actually, Dave was brilliant. A great doctor, really good doctor. No, I mean, that's a fantastic world, a great, great world. Yeah, well, who knows? There's maybe still time.
You're also great in Burke and Hare. Which is,
have you seen Burke and Hare?
Yeah, yeah,
that was
yeah,
the John Landis. John Landis.
Yeah, yeah, John Landis.
Hadn't directed a movie in 12 years.
I know, I know.
Yeah, it was awesome to, I think it was the first, like, after being aware of you, like, the first movie that came out where it was like, oh, it's you. It's like you're right, a star in it, like, you know. Right, and, right, like, right. So I was really excited about it. And it was great. It was a great performance. Really funny and dark and awesome.
Thanks.
Yeah.
I love doing that. And Simon, working with Simon. Simon's a kind of good friend. We got to know each other over the years, and he's brilliant. I mean, yeah. Simon's awesome.
And then episode 7
of what?
Never mind.
Episode 7. That episode 7.
There's only one episode 7. People don't go, "Oh, Police Academy?"
That Mission to Miami?
Yeah.
Of course, if I say anything about it, I will have to shoot you all.
Yes, I know, but it'll be worth it in that last minute.
Whoa. Don't clue me in on this.
No, Jonah. Jonah's got to go first. No, Jonah has to go first.
I don't know much about no Star Treks.
It's not Star Treks.
It's the other one?
It's the other one.
Battlestar Galactitrax.
It's Battlestar Wars. I mean,
I'll have to do a Jedi mind meld on you.
Damn it. Amazing. Another amazing mashup. But, you know, it's your comfort level on these types of projects now. I mean, like, these are the biggest projects. These are the biggest thing. That, I think that's what's sort of interesting, too, is that you work on the biggest things, and then you also kind of take time to work on some of the smallest things because you just enjoy doing that stuff at the same time.
I have been so lucky. I wouldn't have imagined in a million years I would have ended up working on, you know, projects of this scale. For a long time, you know, starting off in theatre and then starting off in independent British movies and, you know, wanting to make small films and all of that. Yeah, you know, it was a huge turning point, Lord of the Rings. Huge, huge, huge. And it opened up. And I think my expectations were that, you know, I was a huge fan of Mike Leigh and Ken Loach and those British filmmakers, which were all about, you know, quite political filmmakers. And I think the big transition for me was realizing that you could actually say something political in a blockbuster movie. And actually, the Planet of the Apes movies are a good example. They are what I've loved about these films and working with Rupert Wyatt and Matt Reeves on this one is that you can actually say something about the human condition that has relative importance to a huge audience, and that's why I think I don't know, I think it's sort of come to me and sort of, well, sort of taken me and pulled me into this world. I mean, even with a character like Gollum, you know, really the themes of Lord of the Rings and sort of politically what was going on, you know, 9/11 around the times of the Two Towers being made, these sort of zeitgeisty sort of moments of, you know, this Dawn of the Planet of the Apes is very much about empathy and the comparing empathy and fundamentalism and really that's what Caesar is all about. You know, what do you fight? How far do you fight for what you believe is right and what you hold true to yourself? And at what point does that become exclusive and fascistic? And you know, and really, it's all this Dawn of the Planet of the Apes is all about prejudice and versus empathy and trying to understand the other and not being speciesist and they're huge themes. And of course, all of these, but all of the, you know, the good films, the, you know, the good Star Trek movies that JJ's made, you know, that they all do work on all of those levels. And I think that's something I wasn't prepared for or didn't really think really existed, even because I used to love Planet of the Apes when I was a kid, but I wasn't necessarily aware of the social commentary.
Well, I didn't consider myself a speciesist, but I do think that if a gorilla walked into this room, I would ask it to leave.
Chris,
what? I would ask. Last two questions.
It's very interesting. Let me just add to that. We did a Q&A a couple of weeks ago in London, and there was a primatologist that came, and we were showing clips of Dawn, and he is campaigning for ape rights, so the equivalent of human rights for apes, so that they, you know, that if an ape is killed by you know, it is considered murder, and he's actively, well, he's asked me to be an ambassador for it, which is a very, very interesting. I mean, it is. You know, it's a very, very interesting argument. You know, given that they're 97% genetically the same as us. So, again, it's very much it's very much in the mix of what we're talking about in terms of these movies. Anyway, sorry.
They're going to take us over, though, guys. I mean, this movie is a roadmap for what's going to happen. We are going to be crushed at the hands.
Is that such a bad thing?
Yeah. I'm not saying it's bad. I'm just saying it's a roadmap.
We've had a good time at the wheel.
We had a good run.
Yeah.
So last two questions. Are you working on a directing? You said you were into directing. Like there was that you were heavily into directing at the moment. So what are you? Last two questions. What are you directing that we're working on, and what's the Imaginarium up to at the moment?
Well, they're both interlinked, those two questions, because we are, at the moment, we have been, over the course of the last year and a half, 2 years, evolving our methodologies for creating Animal Farm, for George Orwell's Animal Farm, which I'm going to direct, using performance capture technologies for all the actors to play all the characters. And then about 6 months ago, I was approached by Warners to direct Jungle Book. Mm-hmm. So that has sort of switched places. We're now currently working on that, and it's really, really exciting. It's a fantastic script, absolutely wonderful script by Callie Clovis. It's being produced by Steve Clovis, and it's really dark. It's very
so. This is different than because Disney's doing a version.
Disney's
too.
Doing
yeah.
a version. They're doing. John Favreau's doing.
Favreau's doing
version,
it, yeah.
Which I think is very much honoring the 1968 Disney.
And you're doing more of the
version.
Kipling version.
We're doing a much, much darker. Very, very much more aligned to Rudyard Kipling. It's a very cool script. Oh. Really, really cool script.
Well, I cannot thank you enough for being here, and it was lovely to get to. It was really great to get to chat with you, and hopefully, I'll see you at. Are you going to be at Comic-Con this year?
Quite possibly.
All right, well,
but then maybe not.
Do you know?
but possibly.
It's still a ways away. Anything could happen at
but
this point.
But thank you. No, I've had a great time.
Oh,
gosh.
Good.
Yeah, it's been lovely. I wasn't expecting this at all.
No, because I'm sure you're probably doing a shit ton of junket stuff. And it's just like, if you were an ape, what type of ape would you be? If Caesar were president, what would he say?
That's very good. God, I wish the junket questions were like that.
Yeah.
If only.
Yeah. But it's good to see you, Andy. Thank you so
thank
much
you.
For being here.
Thanks very much. Cheers.
Enjoy your burrito, everyone.
Yeah, thank you so
thank
much.
Thank you. Cheers.
The big question is, did we earn the signing of the guest?
Oh, I absolutely. Did I earn it, more to the point?
Yes, of course.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
Nancy's love story could have been ripped right out of the pages of one of her own novels.
She was a romance mystery writer who happens to be married to a chef.
But this story didn't end with a happily ever after.
When I stepped into the kitchen, I could see that Chef Brophy was on the ground, and I heard somebody say, call 911.
As writers, we'd written our share of murder mysteries. So when suspicion turned to Dan's wife, Nancy, we weren't that surprised.
The first person they look at would be the spouse.
We understand that's usually the way they do it.
But we began to wonder, had Nancy gotten so wrapped up in her own novels?
There are murders in all of the books.
That she was playing them out in real life? You can listen to Happily Never After, Dan and Nancy, early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.